Many years ago, when I was starting my work as a DJ and trying to develop my own ideas, obviously I needed to listen to other great DJs. And today, from Radio Caroline and from Radio Luxembourg, the two stations I certainly listen to, Tony Prince, this is my chance to meet the man himself. So it's great news that I have with me on the line Tony Prince, and as a fan from many, many years ago, Tony, I'd like to go right back to the first times that I would have been listening to you either on Radio Luxembourg or Radio Caroline, because what I try to do with these podcasts is to talk with people whose work I have admired, be it sort of in a direct fashion or something that's happened along the way. And this is right at the very beginning of when I started getting interested. I think the first radio station I actually listened to was AFN. Do you remember the AFN?
Oh, of course I do, yeah. But that was before the light program, was it? I think we were all stuck with the light program during the day, and in the night we all were quenching our thirst for music with Radio Luxembourg before the pirate ships came along.
Exactly, exactly. And, of course, you know, like so many people that probably you've either met or spoken with over the years, I then started writing my letters to BBC local radio, because the Merseyside station came online, I think it was 1969, and I'd already collected lots of rejection slips from Radio Luxembourg and from Manx Radio.
How dare they reject me?
But yeah, but we didn't have sort of a great choice in those days, did we?
No, you either went to the BBC or you went to Radio Luxembourg. You could count the name DJs on your two hands back in those days.
Yes.
There just weren't outlets for DJs, you know. You had people like Pete Murray, Alan Freeman, David Jacobs, Sam Costa, people like that, you know.
Yes.
We won't mention Jimmy Savile, he's kind of like edited out of our life now.
Well,
that was what we had, and then the pirates came along and changed the whole ball game for everyone.
Yes, and that's, I suppose, would be about the time that I really, you know, took a great interest in radio in general, because prior to that it had always been my mum singing around the house as she was maybe doing the vacuuming or something like that.
I bet she was singing Frank Sinatra songs.
Maybe a bit of Frankie Vaughan.
Of Elvis.
Maybe a bit of Elvis, but I mean, these are very, very dim and distant memories. But what I would like to really sort of ask you is that, obviously, you must have done something that I either didn't do or hadn't thought of, which was the way that you actually got onto the radio in the first place. Can you remember your first letter or how it worked?
Well, mine, you know, I've got a book coming out now called The Royal Ruler and the Railway DJ, and it's all described in that book in detail. To give you a brief account of how I got into radio, you have to go back to my days as a singer with a group, which became a singer with a big band orchestra, which became me getting expelled from the Musicians' Union, because when the band had a break down at the Top Rank in Bristol, I played records. And this was 1963. Records were new in ballrooms, and the Musicians' Union didn't like them one bit. So they asked me to stop playing the records, and Top Rank Dancing used me as a bit of a scapegoat to test this keep music live rule. And I was accordingly expelled and thrown out of the union. So then I became a full-time DJ. I was on a TV show in Bristol called Distagogo, as well as doing the Top Rank gig. So life was full. And then one day, Tony Blackburn came to the TV show, and I'd heard he was a pirate DJ. We couldn't hear Caroline in Bristol, but he told me all about it, and it sounded really exciting, sounded like what I would like to do. So when the TV show came to an end, I went to see the people Tony sent me towards, and that's how I got my first DJ job. I think they were impressed, Vince, because I was coming out of television onto radio.
Right.
Normally it was the other way around. You know, people came from radio and went to television, like Simon Dee, for example.
Yes, yes. But you came from the north of England, didn't you?
I certainly did, but they moved me down to Bristol because we had a great band and we were at the Oldham Top Rank. I introduced the Beatles at the Oldham Top Rank the night Please Please Me went to number one. So I was there right at the start of Beatlemania. I'd met Ringo Starr before that night when he was in a group called Rory Storm and the Hurricanes.
Yes, yes,
which everybody on Merseyside will know.
Yeah.
He was the drummer in that band. They were playing Butlin's Patelli. I was on holiday, and he persuaded me to go in for the talent competition. I came second.
Right.
And he lent me a pair of his cowboy boots to wear while I sang, Bee-bop-a-loo-loo, she's my baby.
I still use that, by the way. I do go out as guitar vocal, and I have a cabaret act as well. But
I have heard of you, Vince.
Well, tell
you're
me
playing all the big venues in Spain now, aren't you?
Yeah, we do. You know, in fact, the way that it's all progressed, I came out here to do my rock and roll show, and then the radio came back into my life. So I did radio professionally for 10 years here, and then because basically, as you build up the contacts, I've been able to go and do both my rock and roll act and my Irish monk act in both
Very
America
good.
And Australia. So,
and who's the Vince and the Cadillacs? Who was that Vince?
Well, that certainly wasn't me. No.
No, there was Vince somebody and the Cadillacs, I seem to recall. Mm. What a great name. But in those days, you had to come up with a great name. I'm taking it Vince is probably not your real name.
No, my real name is actually Vince.
Is and, it? Not yeah. Vincent?
No, well, it is Vincent, you're right. and it's
well,
funny.
I've got to tell you, Vince, my real name was Tommy Whitehead. And when I became a singer with the band in Oldham, we had to change our names. You couldn't be a rock and roll singer and call yourself Tommy Whitehead. So I became Tommy Prince. Mm. And then when I became a DJ, I became Tony Prince.
Right. And I had the problem of when I went to try and get my equity card, they said I couldn't call myself Vince or Vincent.
There was already one out there.
Yeah. And funnily enough, the guy that was using Vince got himself a bit of a bad name down in Cornwall where we'd gone to live. And I went to try and get into a particular holiday camp group, and they were telling me that, you know, I've had history with them, and of course I hadn't, and that was...
That was the other fella.
Yeah, so that wasn't too good. Okay, so I'm trying to sort of piece together certain things, because over the years, I eventually went into teaching. I went into Cornwall, basically because I wasn't getting the breaks on the radio stations. Developed that career and then went out to do my rock and roll show as a bit of light relief, and then radio came back. So what I wanted to know was, did you feel in any shape or form that your education helped you progress from school into what you wanted to do?
Not really, no. I left secondary modern school because I passed an exam to go to Oldham Art School. So I wasted two fabulous years of education in Oldham Art School, coming next to the bottom of the class both years. So when I was 15 and it was time to get out there in the world, I hadn't got any idea what to do. I really didn't know. We went to see the careers officer, which you had to do in those days.
Yes.
And he looked at your exam results and he looked at what you'd been good at and bad at. He said, what do you want to do, Tommy? And I said, I'll tell you what, I'd love to be a reporter on the Oldham Chronicle. And of course, he probably spotted that you need to spell well if you're going to be a reporter. And people have to be able to decipher your handwriting, and that was pretty abject as well. So he said, why don't you be an engineer or go and work in a car company? And he made these suggestions. I said, nah, I don't fancy that. So anyway, I went back to the class and I told a couple of people I was friendly with that I hadn't had much success with this careers officer. And a girl said to me, Tommy, why don't you be a jockey? You're just the right size. Now, she was a Mad Horse fan and she gave me a couple of addresses for stables who might employ me and blow me down. The first one I wrote to came back and offered me a 3-month trial. and that was the Gerald Armstrong stable in Yorkshire. I went there. I shared a bedroom with Willie Carson, who became the Queen's jockey.
Yes.
But I only stuck it out for about 6 months. I went right into the winter on the moors in Yorkshire on those big horses. Wasn't right for me. So I came home, got an ordinary job in the co-op, selling radios, funnily enough. And then I went to Butlins and met this group. And then I got a job as an apprentice toolmaker. So I was now wearing, a boiler suit during the day, being taught how to be an engineer. And at night I was doing all the clubs and pubs in Manchester and Oldham with the Jasons, was the name of the group. And I was their lead singer. Anyway, one thing led to another. The boys wouldn't turn professional. We were offered a season at Butlins, and they wouldn't take it. They all had good jobs. One was a fireman, one was an accountant, one was a plumber. They wouldn't give up their jobs. Well, I had nothing to lose, and all I wanted to do was be a professional musician or be in the entertainment industry. So I said, okay, guys, you go your way, I'll go mine. So I went solo, a bit like you, Vince, and then I was in the Oldham Top Rank the night it opened, and I was stood at the bar, and Johnny Francis, the band leader, came over. I knew him from another venue in Oldham where I'd played with my group, so we knew each other quite well. He said, what are you doing? I said, I'm not doing anything. I'm just going around the clubs as a solo artist and going in for talent competitions and God knows what. He said, Tommy, we're looking for a lead singer. Why don't you join my band? And I looked out and there's this wonderful 15-piece dance band with just a girl singer, and they're looking for a male singer. So I took the job. I threw away my boiler suit. I gave my micrometer away to our road manager who worked with me at that engineering factory, and I said goodbye to ordinary working life and became a professional singer, guitarist, and then I got offered the job to do the records as well. So that's the kind of patchwork quilt of my career.
Wow, it's a fantastic story. And what really, really interests me is it's so similar in many ways to things that, you know, I've been involved with. But of course, I used to switch on and listen to your Royal Regal Rockin' Ruler, if I remember it correctly.
That's right, in the Prince's Palace of Peachy Platters, where nothing else matters but the good times.
And, you always did make it sound that you were having a good time. And I think
you know what, Vince? We always were having a good time. How could you not have a good time being on the greatest radio station in the world, playing the greatest music in the world, and knowing that when you're playing that music, you're not just broadcasting to Great Britain. The whole of Europe is listening to you.
Yes.
I mean, we estimated that between 50 and 100 million listeners at its peak. This is where the Beatles were born, on Radio Luxembourg, because Luxembourg played everything first. Elvis was born on Radio Luxembourg. All the exposure came from Radio Luxembourg. And there I was, after Radio Caroline ended and it was made illegal to be a pirate. You could either go to the new BBC Radio 1 or you could go to Luxembourg, and I got offered the Luxembourg job, and I spent 16 years working for that wonderful company.
Around that time would have been probably the first time I wrote to the BBC, and this was ahead of Radio Merseyside opening, and I got an interview with the guy's name was Tony Wolfe, and I remember him and a couple of other people. And they said to me that they said my accent is totally wrong and I had to go away and get rid of my Liverpool accent. Now,
what a load of nonsense. What a load of tosh.
Well, do you know, it's so strange because one of my really good friends here, you might remember the name Paul Melba.
Oh, I do, yes. Well, and I remember Billy Butler.
Well, Billy Butler and I did work with Billy for a while, but...
you see, Billy had the same problem. This prejudice against Northern accents that they seem to have at the BBC.
Yes.
I mean, I don't say that was why they turned me down, but I've got more audition tapes at the BBC than you have, Vince, I can tell you. I can show you half a dozen letters tomorrow from every controller of Radio 1 who turned me down.
Mm.
You know, we've all been there, mate.
Well, it's
that's just life. You just have to get on with it and see what else you can do.
Well, to be honest with you, you see, this is exactly how I feel. You know, I've got this wad of papers, which is interesting when I tried to explain to other people, because I was actually getting into a college in Cornwall where I was teaching kids who wanted to do things like what we'd become, you know. And so I was trying to show them that, you know, you've got to put up with disappointment, and eventually something could come back in your life, not knowing that I'd come out to Spain and be given an opportunity to get back into broadcasting on one of the national broadcasting stations here.
There you go. Well, the thing is, Vince, you know, the message to kids is never give up.
Yes.
You know, we all struggled. Everybody struggled, you know, some had it easier than others. But just never give up. If you really want to do something, you've just got to keep trying.
Yes.
Until the day you die.
Yes. Now, let me just ask you...
Buddy Holly said, that'll be the day when I die.
did you ever have a point in your life where you weren't too sure how much you were respected as a musician and how much it mattered whether you were respected as a musician? And how much maybe people just thought that, you know, being a DJ was something that anybody can do?
Well, you know, you've got to read the book, Vince. There's some real good little anecdotes in there. There's one where one of Deep Purple once said to me, DJs are just parasites of our music. I said, what do you mean? He said, well, you know, you just play our music. You're riding on the back of what we do. I said, what a load of nonsense. Said, what you don't realize is that every DJ, he may never have yet learned to play a chord on the guitar or a chord on the piano or a run, but I can tell you one thing, every DJ I know is a musician in his heart. He wants to play music, he loves music, and he wants to, it's like playing something to your best friend for the first time. Have you heard this?
Yes.
Well, multiply that by a full 1 hour show, and that's what the DJ is going through. And don't ever forget, Deep Purple, that these DJs make your record popular. That's when you become millionaires. So you should never call DJs parasites. Or you might find our industry stops playing Deep Purple.
Yes.
Then you won't have a parasite in your life that's made it good for you.
Yes.
So I was pretty angry with that, you know, and I hope that that kind of explains to your listeners, you know, what I think about the DJ industry. I mean, the DJ now has become a musician. I'm very vindicated because he has become a musician.
Yeah.
And I've got a company that played a big part in making them musicians, a company called DMC, which started the remixing and the mega mixing in 1983. But, you know, my story on Radio Luxembourg is a long way away from DMC, and my book, The Royal Ruler and the Railway DJ, ends in 1983. When I leave Radio Luxembourg to start DMC.
Right. Well, again, I can see a connection, and I hope you see the same sort of things that I'm thinking about. I published my book 3 years ago now, and it was going really looking at the whole way I've managed to get myself from one situation to another and then out to Spain. And then in 2007, of course, the recession came along, and we had the problems with the radio station, the same as for everybody. The recession started to bite, and they closed down our branch of this big radio broadcaster in Spain. We were the international branch, and they closed us down when probably they would have been better keeping it going. And, you know, I had to start thinking of other things to do. Just prior to that, they'd cut the budget dramatically, and so I started trying to get my podcast started as a way of trying to help the station to get good names to show what we could do on our own rather than having to rely on the Spanish company's budget, you know. So I can see great similarities in that. Let me ask you also about, you know, when you've come from one radio station and its listeners, be it Caroline, and gone to Luxembourg, have you found each time that you've come up with new, totally new audiences, or have your older audiences switched to your new station?
Well, when we moved from Caroline to Luxembourg, Caroline was made illegal. One of them carried on for a while with Johnny Walker and Robbie Dale, but it petered out, and the Caroline North station disappeared eventually, the one I'd been on. And yeah, my audience was always there. You know, I inherited a bigger audience. I mean, Caroline North only broadcast to the north of England, Ireland, Scotland. Didn't get down to the south of England. I think that was one of the reasons that none of the DJs on Caroline North were ever courted or offered a job on the BBC, because they simply didn't listen to the Caroline North station in London. All the DJs from Caroline South did get jobs. So, you know, that's something we all had to live with. We didn't know why that was happening, but I got offered the job on Radio Luxembourg, and I took the job with both hands, went out to the Grand Duchy with Paul Burnett, Kid Jensen, and Noel Edmonds. We were the first four-ball, the first foursome who were live, living in Luxembourg, broadcasting live every night. Before that, it had been all pre-recorded on tape with your big names like Alan Freeman and Pete Murray and so on. So we were the new breed DJs, the ones who'd been inspired by pirate radio, and we inherited a bigger audience than I'd ever had before. We've got the whole of Great Britain now, and we've got the whole of Europe. And my book is about a Czechoslovakian DJ who's a mad Radio Luxembourg fanatic, Jan Sestak. And you've got to read his story as a fan of Radio Luxembourg, which, you know, is in conjunction with my technical life and his dark and, you know, Russian invasions, communist overseeing, secret police. He wanted to be a DJ. And how he pushed through to become a DJ in a country where he couldn't buy a tape recorder, there was no shop selling records, they never knew what the Beatles looked like for a year. You know, there's some incredible stories going on in this book. And I've written it with Jan because I wanted to show the two different teenage worlds, how restricted it was under communism in the Eastern Bloc, and how free we were and having fun over the other side of the Iron Curtain. So that's what my book's about, and I hope people will recognize it as a completely unique view on teenage life in the 60s and 70s.
We need to know where we can get hold of that, by the way.
Yeah, it's coming out on Amazon in the new year, in January.
Yeah.
It's there now, but it's quite pricey at the moment. I think Amazon will discount it in January, so people are probably better waiting whilst the new year. But if they want it right now, it's quite expensive, but it is a hardback. It is 460 pages. It's a really good long read with lots of little chapters leading from Jan to Tony, from Tony to Jan. And it's the kind of book you can pick up and read for half an hour and come back to it tomorrow. Everybody who's read it so far, I mean, the reviews on Amazon are just absolutely incredible. I'm bowled over by them. So if anybody goes to Amazon and just, you know, searches for Tony Prince, it will take you to the book. But next year, I think Amazon will probably discount it significantly, and that's maybe when we start, you know, getting the sales we're looking for. I'll be on things like the Steve Wright Show and various radio stations here in the UK. So it's now down to promoting it, and hopefully, after writing it for 16 years, we will finally get the results we were looking for. A best-selling book about the real boat that rocked, about the great Radio Luxembourg, and about what it was like under communism.
I'm going to look forward to reading this myself, by the way. Okay, I've picked up a couple of coincidences which I want to just go over. The first one is, when I was just going into work at Radio Merseyside, they had no jingles for me, so I sent away to Canada for some jingles, and they sent back Vince the Prince. Now, I'd not asked them to, but I've used that ever since. So we're both princes. That's the first thing. the second one was Paul Burnett. Paul Melba, who I tell you, that, you know, I was telling you that we play golf together regularly. So I've got to know Paul very well. And Paul Burnett's dad was Paul's MD, which I think they lived up in Moira, if I'm not mistaken, not too far from where you would have been.
Really?
Mm.
Well, Moira was where I had a summer place. We had a villa there. Yeah, I loved Moira. I loved that whole coast. It was fantastic.
Yeah.
But I started a TV channel on Sky called Wedding TV, and that meant I couldn't get down on holiday like we used to do. so I sold it rather than just have it down there for 2 or 3 weeks holiday a year. But yeah, and I had a place in Puerto Banús as well, just underneath the Bullring there. Yeah, I love Spain.
Yes.
Can't wait to get back.
Well, I you know, you don't necessarily come away from England to escape. I mean, I really went to, I went and studied communities, and then I went into community radios, studied that in France, and then came to Spain as part of a bit of an adventure, really. And in fact, the other thing I was going to tell you was, you know, when you were telling me about the reaction regarding the DJs and the way they could have been perceived by certain groups, I was lucky enough to have a nice interview with Brenda Lee, and she...
I've heard it.
Oh, have you? Oh, yeah. Well, I was so chuffed the way she immediately was so nice with, you know, I was talking to her about that... that particular aspect of, you know, being a showbiz celebrity, and she was so nice and so just appreciative of what the fans have done for her. What a nice lady.
What you've got to remember, of course, Vince, is that people like Brenda Lee have had every question in the world thrown at them. They're used to doing interviews, and they know they've got to remain nice because their fans listen in, you know. But you can't interview anyone who's of that status, who's been in the business for that long, and ask them any question that they haven't been asked before. That is the challenge of a good interviewer, a good DJ, to bring out the story of the person they're talking to and try to come from an original angle, you know.
Yes, yes. Now, I'm not sure if you're aware, but the Cool FM you were on, I think 2 weeks ago now, is where I present a show on Sundays. And I just happened to be listening, I think it was the week after I'd done a particular thing. And, of course, at the minute I heard the Australian guys, I think they were introducing you. Obviously, I immediately kept the radio on, and I was listening to your days with Ronan O'Reilly and Radio Caroline. And can you tell me anything at all about the man that struck you about, you know, the whole concept of Radio Caroline and your time in that type of environment?
Well... I mean, this is a book in itself, if you want to talk about Ronan O'Reilly. I mean, he is one of music culture's great heroes. I mean, even the people in America should bow and, you know, pay homage to Ronan O'Reilly, because we broke all those 60s group on Radio Caroline. And then along came Radio London, and Caroline became Caroline South and Caroline North. And then we had Radio Scotland, Radio 270 off Scarborough, Radio England, Britain Radio, and we had a flotilla around the United Kingdom bombarding the kids with pop music. And so groups like, you know, the Beatles, the Searchers, the Rolling Stones, the Kinks, they all got their UK exposure. The big hits came through from the pirate radio, and those kind of bounced over into America. So the British culture that they all loved over in America was all because of Ronan O'Reilly's exposure device, a pirate ship 3 miles outside in international waters, so that the government couldn't do anything about it. And Ronan's passion for what he'd created was incredible, but I would say this, he probably wasn't a great businessman. He actually, in the end, had to bring in businessmen to help him survive. One of them was Phil Solomon, who used to be my manager, actually, him and his wife, Phil and Dorothy Solomon. That's another story in itself. But Phil wasn't, let's say, an apostle of pop music. He was a businessman, and he wanted money out of Radio Caroline. He had a record label, and his brother in Northern Ireland had a record label. And the tunes that they had on those labels weren't Category 1, and we were forced to play them. And that's when we all got a little bit disenchanted with Radio Caroline out at sea, towards the end of its legal life, and why most of us quite happily left, because we knew that the spirit of Ronan O'Reilly had kind of shriveled up and gone. Business had to take over to keep the ship out there, and it was a damn shame, really. But Ronan continued after the bill for many years, keeping the ship going, begging and borrowing money to keep it going. I mean, George Harrison of the Beatles used to stuff some money into his bank account to keep it going. And that was seemed to be what Ronan's focus was. I went out for lunch with him a couple of years after Caroline was made illegal, and all he wanted was to see if I would support him with any money. I said, I'm sorry, you know, Ronan, you've done the job. I don't see any reason for Caroline to be out there now. We've got all these local stations starting. You know, we've got BBC getting their act together. And really, you know, Caroline had his day. And I don't think it would be prudent of anyone now to put money into it. He was very upset with me. But anyway, hopefully he forgave me. And he's now back in Ireland. I hear he's not very well, and he has a girlfriend looking after him over there. And I'm told he can't really remember much. He's got some Alzheimer's problem, I'm told. So that's all very sad. But he was a god amongst the media that we work in. And I'm always saying to people, this man we owe so much to. We can't imagine how much we owe to Ronan O'Reilly.
Yeah, yeah. I think it's wonderful what you've just told me, and you know it encapsulates so much of what I've seen in my life, and obviously listening to such enthusiasm in your voice for somebody whose name is a legend, that sometimes you'll talk to people and they've never heard it, which is just nonsensical, really. Tony, as we're coming to the end of this...
We all, Vince, had a big passion for Radio Caroline and the Pirates. And my book, The Royal Ruler and the Railway DJ, begins, the very first chapter I write about, is Tony Blackburn climbing to the top of the mast on Radio Caroline in a force 10 gale with the ship shaking from side to side. You got to the top of the mast and you're going 40 feet that way, 40 feet that way, just to release a cable at the top of the mast that was stopping us from broadcasting. It was short-circuiting the transmitter. So we all had a go climbing up there, but it was good old Blackburn who went right to the top. So I open with that chapter because it demonstrates the passion we all had to change the scene from one where the BBC only played half an hour of records a day. And then along came Ronan with his jukebox tub, his boat called Radio Caroline, and life suddenly became technicolor for teenagers throughout Europe.
We had somebody trying to con a few people out in Spain. It was about 4 years, no, maybe a little less, maybe 2 to 3 years ago. Came out with a mast trying to get a group of people, I just happened to get in on this, to buy a franchise of Radio Caroline. And I'd set up a meeting with a number of people who were interested in maybe investing in this. And I got a message which came to me, an email, telling me that this is a con man, and look at certain pages on the internet, which I went to immediately, and found that Interpol were chasing him, which is so sad because it means that people who don't know the full story, as you will have written in your book and what you've been talking with me about, is being polluted by people who are trying to just make a quick buck and run away from maybe where they've made a few contacts and con people. And of course, that's why I suppose I get cross with certain situations, because I was never there at the very beginnings, but I did get to Radio Merseyside when they were just starting, and I've been involved in radios ever since, and I love radio. And I wanted to actually ask you, do you think that according to the video and the song, do you think that video killed the radio star?
No, I don't. I think radio killed the radio star. The radio star was personality DJs, like Kenny Everett, for example. All the DJs in the 60s were personality-led. Fun people, you never knew what they were going to come out with next. Or slick, like the Emperor Roscoe.
Yes.
Like the Royal Ruler.
Yes.
We were the first breed of DJs trying to translate what DJ meant from the Americanism of DJ. And, of course, when the pirate ships began, we had lots of Americans, Canadians, and Australians on those ships. And they were the ones who taught we Brits how to be a DJ, because we had no way of learning before the pirate ships. So I'm always grateful to those Americans and Australians and Canadians who showed us the way forward. So what we're talking about now, I've got a series on, you can go to YouTube and you can Google the history of DJ. You'll see 14 episodes which I've created to tell the story of the DJ. And you get to the Radio Pirate era, there's about three or four episodes of that. Radio Luxembourg is about three episodes of that. So it's the history of DJ. If you Google that, if your listeners Google that, they can watch these videos and see how radio grew. Now, you asked a question, I'm going to get to the answer now. Did video kill the radio star? No, it didn't. Radio is still going, but now it's splintered into internet activities, downloads, people doing their own playlists. It's got incredible competition now. And what the radio industry has done, it's gone for that tight format, 20 records on regular rotation. Golden oldie stations with the same 300 records that keep getting rotated. I mean, I just don't know how they think that people only want to listen to 20 records all week, or 300 records in a lifetime if they love golden oldie stations. I don't understand that at all. But that's what they've done. And it's those programmers who've gone for the short-term answer who have killed radio. And I do mean killed radio, because radio is not going to survive, in my estimation, unless they bring back those vivacious personality, funny, Billy Butler-type DJs,
yes,
you know, who make you stay tuned, because the records are kind of like, not secondary, but the DJ and what he does between the records is significant entertainment. And so personality DJs will be the savior of radio. And radio in the future has got a lot of problems on its frequencies. So I wish radio good luck, but I'm glad I was there when, I guess, we had a monopoly. It's now just mad how easy it is to get music, but you know, I think radio has only got itself to blame, not video.
Yeah, I feel exactly the same, and I hope in my own way I try to preserve the traditions set by the likes of yourself. Incidentally, I did the Radio One Club with Emperor Roscoe in 1974.
Very good.
So, well, I mean, you know, I'm just trying to sort of throw in things just to show you that really, you know, this isn't just a quick whim. I really, really love radio. I think that listening to the likes of yourself and all the people that have influenced the way that I want to produce my programs, I wanted to make this podcast because basically you are one of the people that I listen to. And a lot of people take ideas from people, but they never acknowledge them. And, you know, I just feel that this, it does actually do this for what I got from the programs that you used to put out. And you'll know at least one person really thought very seriously about what you were doing.
Well, there you go. What you've done here on your blog is you've combined two stories. You've had mine and we've had yours. So now everybody knows your life story. Everybody knows mine. You've done a good job, Vince.
Lovely, Tony. Look, it's been an absolute pleasure speaking with you. And what I'm going to do now, I've prepared a page. I'll put it all connected up into my website and I'll send you the links. And obviously, I will maybe, once the book's out, maybe come back to you and ask you a bit more about the book.
Okay, Vince, thank you very much. Hasta mañana.
Hasta mañana. Muchísimas gracias.
Hola.
Thank you. Bye-bye.